so why don't you guys buckle up and join the ride, because we're going to have some fun going green.
And Abby said, you shouldn't commit illegal acts, except perhaps at night and with your parents' permission.
Your advice is making less sense than usual.
Well, the important thing is family and friendship, honesty, values, and no one got arrested.
You see this jerk? This is the same thing. Kropotkin was the same jerk, and Bakunin was the same jerk. Not good. Not good, I'm telling you.
He was a very good dancer.
He's a lowlife.
George Orwell, who definitely didn't like socialism of any kind, warned us against it. He wrote books that said that totalitarianism is bad and that sticking with old ideas is good.
I got news for you. You gotcha. The population again.
I did not know that.
I never thought you'd lose a Stalin debate.
You never expect to walk into one.
Sure.
Avoid Marxism, or telling her you're a Trotskyite.
Trotskyist. Only a Stalinist would call the Trotskyist a Trotskyite, and I'm not a Trotskyist anymore. I'm a Maoist.
Relentlessly anti-Trump and relentlessly pro somebody like Obama.
I'm not pro-Obama. I've been a critic of Obama. I'm a critic of the Democratic Party.
Because
I'm literally a communist.
Well, you know how it is. The main thing is to get those juicy likes and subscribes, and we can get some more of that sweet, sweet communist money rolling in. You know how it is, bro. Gotta get the communist dollar. Gotta make it to the top.
Just imagine somebody saying under cannibalism or under slavery or under dictatorship, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Well, they'd be wrong. There is something you can do about it. You can get beyond these archaic systems and move closer and closer to fulfilling human capacities. And that's what we need to do.
This is Dan Platt live here at WCAA. The Voice, here with your live broadcast of the Three Left Show. Kind of been off and on. I think I record live every other week. This is that week where I'm recording live, if you had noticed. So, I got a lot of good stories today. Let's see, I alternate, if you don't know, between episodes where I just talk about kind of practical, organized, things being organized, and things to do, things to focus on, to have hope in that, you know, these things are happening. And I'm actually going to continue that, but in a bigger picture format. So, like, this is the episode for the big picture, and then in other episodes, I'll focus on small things. Kind of alternating, oscillating is the word, between going between two things that are opposites, but both equally true. Okay, first, some just random jibber-jabber. What I try to do with this show is try to make sure that the stories I'm covering are still relevant in the future. Maybe not far future, but if you listen to this a year from now, I don't want everything to be out of date. You know, I was going over some old projects of mine, potential media things that I, like, notes I took down of, like, videos to make, and I haven't had video skills yet. I don't even have my own camera besides my phone, but a good camera to record things with, and so on. So let's say if I talk about Bernie's announcement this week, just as an example of, like, we're surrounded by media culture of now, of an ever-present, always changing, but always staying the same. Imagine that. Maybe not have to, maybe just consider that all the news stories, the hot takes, the opinion pieces that we're inundated with, are completely irrelevant to you in a year's time. Now, I'd like the show to still be relevant, at least in a, if not a superficial sense, but I want the information and the concepts and the stories I'm talking about to be relevant. Even if I'm talking about a particular rent strike or a particular bit of activism, I want it to link up to the big picture. So I'm going to be doing that this episode. So, but let's say if I do talk about Bernie's announcement, all right, he announced last, I think this is what I was assuming, that he was going to wait and try to be the last person in, you know, to save the best for last, so to speak. So it didn't surprise me at all. I wasn't holding my breath. And the amount of energy for him is certainly good. I mean, this is one of the positives of running multiple times for the same office. You build up name recognition. Any base that you had or people, you know, support you gathered last time carries through, because not much has changed in 2 years. Everything's gotten a little worse, so thus maybe his message is even more inspiring, that to have a positive semi-utopian vision, even if it is just democratic socialism, but that's still further left than what we got, and it's interesting to see on CNN and other, you know, corporate media outlets that they are, in fact, probably being, maybe some of them anyway, some of their talking heads, are being a little more accurate by actually referring to Bernie and his support, which in a Daily Kos poll was like 44% compared to all the rest of the candidates, like 8-5%. So he's a front runner already, at least it's uncertain on that a site like Daily Kos. Oh yeah, they're referring to his fans, you know, as the left. They actually refer to Bernie as like he represents the left, as opposed to all of the corporate candidates that have usually in the past been considered the left. Maybe not anymore. They are the center. I'm not saying it's terrible to be in the center, but if you are wholly owned corporate subsidiary or bought, or simply your interests aligned with their interests, okay, so maybe does not just being corrupt, but just simply being aligned with corporate power and the corporate state. I always want to opine on conservatives and right-wingers that, like, you see his government as the problem, but it's a corporate state. They are inseparable. Everything you hate about the government, corporations also do. One example is bureaucracy. And this is many people in the center, liberals, whatever, will say, like, well, socialism is just one big bureaucracy. Well, yeah, I suppose Walmart is one big bureaucracy, but there are efficiencies there. It was corporations, corporate America specifically, a century and a half ago, that perfected the bureaucracy. Because you can't do big industrial organizing without it, so to speak. So if you want less bureaucracy, you want less industrialism. You want less modern technology because you really can't have any of that. You can't have your Keurig machine. You can't have cell phones without some kind of top-down bureaucracy. And bureaucracies don't work bottom-up. They are a matter of bureaucracies reinforce the power structures that exist already. So they can't really be used to kind of equalize human relations. Just, you know, anytime you call a corporate call center, you interact with that on a regular basis. That could be a good intro to this Counterpunch article. It is called You Can't Go Home Again. The Liberal State is No More. This is by Richard Moser from Counterpunch. So what this article is generally about is about a century and a half ago, the old socialist movements kind of had in the 20s, one of their messages, slogans, was, it is socialism or barbarism. And that was pretty much setting up the dynamic that as the modern democracies of the time, liberal democracies, were in crisis, either from depression or the grumblings leading up to the depression, because people were suffering in the 20s as well, especially after the First World War. I mean, the First World War itself was a major crisis point. And so after that, everything was kind of upended, so to speak. Many empires collapsed in the world. And so people kind of felt that there was kind of a tipping point. And the liberal democracies weren't kind of able to deliver the goods, and they weren't able to deal with problems of the time. So there was kind of a split between either things were going to go fascist or they were going to go more socialist. So if you look historically, that's kind of how things bent. Either you had dictatorships or some other kind of totalitarian government take charge, or you had liberal democracies bend toward labor movements, like in our own country. That is how we got the New Deal, because that was faced with the choice of a fascist movement in America, which was existing and growing at the time, and a socialist movement, which was also growing at the time. Sound familiar? So today, we have neo-Nazis and right-wings, and you can call it the Trump movement or whatever, as represented by Trump. And you have a growing interest and activity around quote-unquote socialism, and a growing resurgent left, a real left, not a left in name, or we're going to call ourselves left, but really cater to corporate interests, like de Blasio, for example, who is, Amazon was defeated in New York, and he whined and said, oh, these activists, they don't know what harm they're causing. We weren't able to get Amazon here and have them pay no taxes. All right, in a previous article, I'm starting now. In a previous article, I argued that often confusing and divergent arguments within the neoliberal critique could be best understood as the tensions between two opposing currents of thought. One tendency understands neoliberalism, by the way, that's the kind of name put to our current situation, as the unfettered reign of the free market, often called free market fundamentalism. The other sees neoliberalism as a fusion of corporate and state, sometimes called corporate power, as I just used. So I guess I'm the latter. If it's FMF, which does, what does that mean for activism? If it's corporate power, what does that imply for strategy? The greater the emphasis on the free market fundamentalism, then the more possible it might seem to re-regulate the corporations back to within tolerable limits after recapturing the state through elections. This is most of the Democratic candidates at the moment. The greater the emphasis on corporate power, the less possible incremental electoral approaches seem, and the more likely that revolutionary measures will be required to abolish corporate power. Okay, so you see where I go with that. Subtitle, You Can't Go Home Again. Free market fundamentalism remains such a popular idea among progressives precisely because it allows us to imagine an easy escape. That escape is a return to the liberal regulatory state that governed the U.S. between the mid-30s and mid-70s, and 1970s, so that's the New Deal era, as many historians call it. The problem, and most likely an insurmountable one, is that the old liberal regulatory state was dismantled and replaced by a new corporate regulatory state. All right? So that's basically 1970s to now. This bit of wishful thinking also forgets that the now defunct liberal state was codified by law and mandated by election due to massive protests and organizing in the 1930s and cemented in place only at the high human cost of the Second World War. The construction of the liberal state required mass movements, some with revolutionary aspirations, and its reconstruction will require nothing less. Equally daunting is the fact that the decline of the liberal state wasn't caused by the rise of neoliberalism alone, but by urban rebellions and social movements. Why would we return to the liberal state that brought us the Vietnam War, Collantropo Pro, which was the federal dismantling of activist organizations from the inside, environmental destruction, and the urban crisis, among other wonders? The Death of the Liberal Class by Chris Hedges argues that the liberals who once managed the regulatory state were marginalized or adapted by the corporate one. And he goes, quote him, "The assault by the corporate state on the democratic one has claimed the liberal class as one of its victims. Corporate power forgot that the liberal class gives legitimacy to the power elite, the millionaires and billionaires, and reducing the liberal class to courtiers who have nothing to offer but empty rhetoric. Shuts off the safety valve and forces discontent to find other outlets. The inability of the liberal class to acknowledge that corporations have wrested power from the hands of citizens, that the Constitution and its guarantees of personal liberty have become irrelevant, and that the phrase, consent of the governed, is meaningless, has left it speaking and acting in ways that no longer correspond to reality." Thus the song and dance circus of most, if not all, the Democratic candidates at this moment. And that goes for Trump, too. So, question. What killed democracy? The answer, corporate empire. Corporate power destroyed the limited democracy of the liberal state because it was an obstacle to its insatiable need for power and profit. If democracy is dead, conclusion we can make, what is the new reality we face? By the 1980s, and as such, many people have given up on democracy. Most of Americans don't vote. Not just it's apathy and hopelessness, but why is there hopelessness? Because it's dead. Why you can't ride a horse that's on the ground? By the 80s, a new version of the two-party system emerged. An extreme right-wing takeover of the Republican Party, accomplished largely by the quote-unquote Reagan Revolution, on the one hand, and the rise of the third way, or corporate Democrats, represented by the Clinton machine, among others. Both wings of one duopoly dedicated to establishing and maintaining a new corporate order, the New World Order, sometimes called, by George H.W. Bush himself. Along with the earlier reconstructing the U.S. government in order to wage our imperial wars, it was this corporate takeover of the political parties and the government they have a chokehold on that killed American democracy. And both parties championed policies that were responsible for the steep decline in the power of the working class, gutting of labor unions, so on and so on. We can follow the money. This new political class managed the fusion of the state and corporation, as can be clearly seen in the history of finance capital. Banks are the executive branch of corporate power, dispatching capital and resources and labor. To the degree that capitalism is planned, bankers do the planning. During the exceptional period of limited economic democracy during the New Deal era, capital was forced to share the wealth. But by the 70s, big changes were underway. As a response to the upheavals of the mid-20th century, the ruling elites asserted their class power and bankers were their vanguard. In All the President's Bankers, the hidden alliance that drove American power, Nomi Prinz documents the relationships between presidents and bankers. By the 80s, that relationship had grown less personal and more institutional. Not only were bankers routinely appointed to powerful government posts, but all agreed that free market neoliberal ideology, that FMF, was the best rhetorical strategy to maintain their hegemony as they created the corporate state. Before long, the power of capital grew to such proportions that it overshadowed even presidential power, as well as the other branches of government. This is why I don't really care who the president is. Perhaps this is what makes Bernie exciting to many people like me, is he doesn't have personal relationships with bankers. Let's see. Banker supremacy was based on the remarkably rapid concentration of capital and control in the hands of a few. Corporate coup, or merger of the corporation and the state. I think they're kind of synonyms at this point. Okay, and we're back after a quick break. So I'll just pick up with my dry, hopefully not dry, not too dry, reading of You Can't Go Back, referring to the liberal regulatory state. So this is just the case. Many progressives and, you know, Democratic candidates, like, say, Elizabeth Warren, at this current time, is like, okay, we can re-regulate capitalism. You know, we don't have to move beyond it. We don't need to talk about moving beyond it, okay? Now, in the past, like, just talking about moving beyond it, having revolutionary movements, is what made the New Deal possible. So if we're going to have a New Deal or a Green New Deal, at the very least, you know, if that's your goal, there needs to be more radical movements to push for it. If you're going to be incremental, you're going to make compromises before you even start. And I think compromise number one is not having the desire to not destroy your opponent, right? The goal, or rather the end result, will not be the destruction of your opponents. You can even have that in mind. But as far as strategy is concerned and like how you actually operate, disarming your opponent, or at least disarming. So was what happened in the last 40 years now, since 1980s, corporate coup or merger of corporation and state? And this is an important point to make when it comes to converting, probably isn't the right word, but say creating a coalition with people of the opposing ideology, right-wingers. Because many conservatives can support socialist policies. Either you don't call them socialist policies, like Green Party candidates and others do, or something needing to be done is the explanation, which is why I'm doing it now, that it isn't just the government. It isn't just the state that you need to be afraid of. There's corporate power. And corporate power and state power are one and the same. Maybe they weren't when you were a kid growing up because you had a state regulation of corporate power. But now it's the other way around, or it's a balance between the two. But so here's a description. The rise of the corporate state was nothing so sudden or confrontational as a coup, nor will it be undone as easily. Corporate power is the outcome of a century of growing corporate influence, imperial war, and the historical development of capitalism itself. There was no hostile takeover. The economic policies of Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump, and the parties they led, fully supported the aims and ambitions of the large banks and corporations. To quote, the federal government and Fed response to the third world debt crisis, SNL bailout, and 1987 stock market crash was to subsidize the banking system with federal and multinational money. The bankers had succeeded in pushing the presidency to back losses. They had succeeded in privatizing the profits and socializing the cost of failure. This fiscal policy had officially become U.S. domestic and foreign policy. If you're in the Occupy movement like me, you heard this many, many times. This was kind of what we were talking about and why we existed. Socializing costs and privatizing profits reached new heights after the 2008 crisis. but the instruments of corporate power are already well in place. On a few days' notice, the elites launched the global bailout of unprecedented scale and scope that rescued banks too big to fail. If you asked how we were going to pay for it all during the height of the crisis, $19 trillion was made available in subsidies and bailouts, profits and wealth, and yada yada. And there's the faux reform of the Dodd-Frank bill. Was a revealing response to the crisis because it only further cemented the corporate state while preserving the largest corporations. And it's been pointed out, even by conservatives, that the Dodd-Frank banking regulation of the Obama administration destroyed many small, whatever was left of the small banking sector, and many cooperative banks and credit unions. To comply with the regulation, they needed to hire legal departments, way oversized legal departments, and that kind of, because basically the regulation favored regulating large banks. It's easier, right? You know, you only have to deal with a few actors, but that is convenient for them, inconvenient for consumers. What is the passage beyond corporate power? So, okay, let's get to the kind of, I like articles and books that have conclusions and action items at the end. Sometimes when I read a book, I'll skip to the last chapter to see if the author suggests what to do about the problem they talk about. I can't stand journalism that just kind of like, okay, you figure it out. I gave you the info, so to speak. So the corporate capture of the state means any return to the liberal regulatory state, let alone a genuine economic democracy, would require something more akin to a revolution. History would suggest that the kinds of popular unrest and social movements responsible for the long period of reform from the Great Depression to the end of the Vietnam War are the true engines of history and should be the true goals of strategy. For it was those movements that both created the liberal state and began a transition beyond it. And in my own readings of the history of that, I think these movements really ended up imploding or kind of being dissolved a bit when they kind of concentrated on electing a president. When it came to the New Left and the anti-war movement, they peaked in 72 when they got the anti-war candidate, Hubert Humphrey, I think it was, as the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. And so you had all these Democrats that were pro-war, they voted for Nixon, creating the quote-unquote silent majority that was pro-war. And thus creating all the buffers of, we're never going to have an anti-war candidate again in the Democrats. We're going to put in superdelegates, and we're going to change all the rules so that movements have a more difficult time, in fact, make it impossible for social movements to, like an anti-war movement, to influence our election process. And that is how it's been. Even now, Bernie, I think, he's definitely abutting some of imperialist policy. For example, he isn't calling for war in Venezuela. But he's still supportive of the war machine. Like, he doesn't vote against funding it. He doesn't, you know, so it's the criticism that all of this is still in place since 72. And it also kind of sucked the air. Like, once you fail at winning the president, like, once you get your candidate as the nominee and then you fail that, what do you do next? In the last revolution, the civil rights, black power, and the peace anti-imperialist movement provided transition beyond what was then called the liberal consensus. Many people started out from a straightforward moral perspective, wanting something that seemed like an achievable and reasonable reform, peace and racial justice. Later, many discovered that the entire system was largely based on racism and empire, and that both parties were guardians of the establishment. So to win those seemingly simple reforms, people had to build disruptive movements that raise the question of capitalism, white supremacy, and empire itself as a necessary part of challenging power. What will allow its passage beyond today's neoliberal consensus? So now we have climate crisis and continuing war. The return of the liberal state will require us to literally live on a different planet. The environmental crisis will prohibit returning to past ways of reforming capitalism, as discussed in previous episodes. Because past models were also based on permanent war, unsustainable growth, and insatiable drive to plunder Earth's resources and human labor, It's unlikely that legislation or even significant electoral victories are going to be enough to re-regulate, let alone dismantle the world's largest empire. Show me an empire dismantled by legislation or an ecosystem saved by the profit motive. Show me an example from history when a crisis of similar proportion and scale to what we currently face was resolved by normal electoral means. When the people of Standing Rock stood up against the most powerful corporate interests in the world, their prayers, their prophecy, their vision was not to cage the black snake, but to kill it. We defeat corporate power, or it will defeat us. Climate destruction may just be our last stand, our greatest opportunity, and most dangerous crisis. But to make the most of it, we'll have to raise revolutionary demands and adopt movement-building strategy that have the best chance of challenging corporate power. Pretty good, pretty good. Okay, so to keep it in the big picture, and trust me, please trust me, I'm going to go more specific as the show goes on. I'm going to talk about our empire, imperialism, as right now, via an article from the Greenville Post, which is the kind of an anti-imperialist news source. And the article is called Making Globalism Great Again. Maybe Donald Trump isn't as stupid as I thought. I hate to have to admit that publicly, but it does seem like he has put one over on the liberal corporate media this time. Scanning the recent Trump-related news, I couldn't help but notice a significant decline in the number of references to Weimar Germany, Hitler, and the brink of fascism that America was supposedly been teetering on since Hillary Clinton lost the election. I googled around pretty well, I think, but I couldn't find a single editorial warning that Trump is about to summarily cancel the Constitution, dissolve Congress, and proclaim himself Führer. How did Trump finally get the liberal corporate media to stop calling him a fascist? He did that by acting like one, which is to say he did the bidding of the deep state goons and corporate mandarins that manage our capitalist empire, the smiley, happy, democracy-spreading, post-fascist version of fascism that we live under. Even though recently he has declared a state of emergency and there is some, but this is all about the wall here. This article is more about Venezuela. And this is what he refers to, which is one of the handful of uncooperative countries that are not playing ball with global capitalism and which hasn't been regime changed yet. Trump greenlit the attempted coup purportedly being staged by the Venezuelan opposition, but which is obviously a U.S. operation. Or rather, a global capitalist operation. As soon as he did, the corporate media immediately suspended calling him a fascist and comparing him to Hitler, and so on, and started spewing out blatant propaganda supporting the effort to overthrow an elected government of a sovereign country. Overthrowing the governments of sovereign countries, destroying their economies and stealing their gold, and otherwise bringing them into the fold of the capitalist international community, is not exactly what most folks thought Trump meant by Make America Great Again. Many Americans had never been to Venezuela or Syria or anywhere else the global capitalist empire has been ruthlessly restructuring since shortly after the end of Cold War. They have not been lying awake at night worrying about Venezuelan democracy or Syrian or Ukrainian democracy. This is not because Americans are heartless people or an ignorant or a selfish people. It is because, well, is because they are Americans, or rather because they believe they are Americans, and thus are more interested in, because they are Americans, and thus they're interested in the problems of Americans than they are in the problems of people in faraway lands that have nothing whatsoever to do with America. Despite what the corporate media will tell you, Americans elected Donald Trump, a preposterous, self-aggrandizing clown, not because they were latent Nazis or because they were brainwashed by Russian hackers, but primarily because they wanted to believe that he sincerely cared about America and was trying to make it great again. But unfortunately, and this is going to sound like Network, the movie, unfortunately there is no America. There is nothing to make great again. America, quote-unquote, is a fiction, a fantasy, a nostalgia that hucksters like Donald Trump and other marginally less buffoonish hucksters use to sell whatever they are selling. Themselves, wars, cars, whatever. What there is, in reality, instead of America, is a supernatural global empire. Decentralized one, independent network, of corporations, financial institutions, other national governments. That includes intelligence agencies and other supranational government entities. It includes the military forces, media, and so on. If that sounds far-fetched and conspiratorial, then look at what is going on in Venezuela. And so he goes on to describe that. The entire global capitalist empire is working in concert to force the elected president of a country out of office. The U.S., U.K., Canada, France, Germany, Spain, Austria, Denmark, Poland, has officially recognized Guaido as a legitimate president, in spite of the fact that no one elected him. Only the empire's official evil enemies, Russia, China, Iran, Syria, Cuba, and other uncooperative countries, are objecting to this democratic coup. And democratic is in quotes. The global financial system, banks, has frozen Venezuela's assets, and it's attempting to transfer them to Guaido so he can buy the Venezuelan military. The corporate media are hammering out the official narrative like a Goybean piano in an effort to convince the general public that all of this has something to do with democracy. What is happening has nothing to do with America. The America that that Americans believe in and that many of them want to make great again. What is happening is exactly what has been happening around the world since the end of the Cold War. A bit most dramatically in the Middle East, the de facto global capitalist empire is restructuring the planet with virtual impunity. It is eliminating any and all impediments to the hegemony, meaning the dominance of global capitalism, and the privatization and commodification of everything. Keep that in mind when there's a new app to monetize your time. Venezuela is one of these impediments. Overthrowing the government has nothing to do with America or the lives of us Americans. It is not going to conquer Venezuela and plant an American flag, though. America is not going to steal its oil, ship it home, and parcel it out to Americans in their pickups and Walmart parking lots. What about those American oil corporations, though? They want the oil, don't they? Well, sure they do. But here's the thing. There are no quote-unquote American oil corporations. Corporations, especially the billion-dollar kind, are transnational. They have no nationalities, no real allegiance other than to their major shareholders. Now, maybe a good chunk of them are American, but that's not always the case. Chevron, for example, whose major stockholders are asset management and mutual fund companies like BlackRock, Vanguard Group, and so on. They're also transnational multi-trillion dollar outfits. And that's, yes, trillion with a T. Do you really believe that being nominally headquartered in Boston or New York makes these companies American or New Yorkers? Or the Deutsche Bank is a German bank or the BP is a British company? And Venezuela is just the most recent blatant example of an empire in action. Ask yourself, honestly, what have the regime change jobs done for the greater Middle East? Done for any actual Americans, other than get a lot of them killed? Oh, and how about those bailouts for all those transnational American investment banks? Or the billions American provides to Israel? Someone please explain how enriching the shareholders of transnational corporations like Raytheon, Boeing, and Lockheed Martin by selling billions in weapons to Saudi Arabian Islamists is benefiting the American people. How much of that Saudi money are you seeing? And wait, I've got another one for you. Can your friendly 401k manager ask how Pfizer shares are doing, then compare that to what you're paying some American insurance corporation to not really cover you? All comes back around. 200 years or so, we have been conditioned to think of ourselves as citizens of a collection of sovereign nation states, as Americans, Germans, Greeks, and so on. There's no more sovereign nation states, or at least their power is eroded. Global capitalism has done away with them, which is why we're experiencing a neo-nationalist backlash. Trump, Brexit, the so-called new populism, these are the death throes of national sovereignty, like the thrashing of a suffocating fish before you whack it and drop it in a cooler. The battle is over, but the fish doesn't know that yet. It doesn't even realize that there was a battle until it suddenly got jerked up out of the water. In any event, here we are, the advent of global capitalist empire. We are not going back to the 19th century, nor even the 20th. Neither Donald Trump nor anyone else is going to make America great again. Global capitalism will continue to remake the world into one gigantic marketplace where we work ourselves to death at bullcrap jobs in order to buy things we don't need, accumulating debt we can never pay back, the interest on which will further enrich the global ruling class, who, as you William Mill noticed, are preparing for the future by purchasing luxury underground bunkers and post-apocalyptic compounds in New Zealand. That and militarizing the police, who they will need to maintain, quote-unquote, public order. You know, like they were doing in France at the moment, by beating, blinding, and hideously maiming those yellow vest protesters that the corporate media are doing their best to demonize or ignore. Or, who knows, Americans and other Western consumers might take a page from those yellow vests, set aside their political differences, or at least ignore their hatred of each other long enough to actually achieve something, and focus their anger at the politicians and corporations that actually run the empire, as opposed to, you know, illegal immigrants, imaginary legions of Nazis, and Russians. This is written by C.J. Hopkins. Now, the last paragraph kind of seems to make a slight at Antifa and anti-fascist activism, but the point of that activism is to prevent legions of Nazis from existing. To, if it is a flopping fish, to put it in the cooler as quickly as possible. Or maybe throw it back in the water. Nah, that's probably not what we want to do. More of a screed against nationalist rhetoric, okay? You can take it, I take it, as kind of a critique of nationalism itself. Because our current conditions are such, like our economy is not a national economy. All the big companies, the things, the entities that dominate it are not within America's borders. Maybe they're headquartered here, but they're certainly not paying taxes here, and they're not really doing anything of benefit for the average American. And there's all this rhetoric that they are, that we need them here, that if we raise taxes, they'll move somewhere else. Well, in some ways, they already have moved elsewhere, as many corporations do, to tax havens. Oh, but the jobs. As such, like, shouldn't we have more responsible industries, more national industries, American industries? But otherwise, when it comes to kind of left-right unite calls to action, like this last paragraph, I'm a little skeptical. I've yet to see it done effectively. In my lifetime, I suppose I'm speaking. You know, my father can give me plenty of examples. He was mentioning to me, Clean Air Act was passed with movements of both lefties like him and righty hunters, fishermen, and outdoorsmen, because conservationism is not as partisan. Well, it is partisan. It's just a matter of, are you a corporate power or not? You know, there's grassroots and there's not. Top down, bottom up. So as far as left, right, unite, there still needs to be a community empowerment, bottom up ethic. And that's how, even if you have revolutionary rhetoric like mine, the end result is just community empowerment. And if you're right wing, or rather not right wing, but conservative, right? Conservative values, go to church, nuclear family kind of stuff, then that's fine. That's not something that's going to be banned or needs to be banned, because community empowerment means less state power, which means less corporate power, because they're one and the same. And they both need to be fought, because it's the same thing. And if conservatives or right-wingers are ineffectual, it's because they're only focusing on the state. If liberals or progressives are ineffectual, it's because they only focus on corporate power. And they want the state to regulate again. But you can't go back. Right? You can't go back to those things where you have one that's stronger than the other. Now I think the choice, rather the thing to do, is lessen the power of both. And that means raising communities up. That real political power in the hands of communities. And that means community organizing. Right? Not for the purpose of electing people. Right? Because like Obama, community organizer, but for its own ease, for its own end, like Cooperative Jackson. But again, these movements get sidetracked into electoralism. But otherwise, I'm going to focus now in the last bit of the hour on a story from the Red Phoenix newspaper of the American Party of Labor, which I real party, but it's certainly an organization, and they have a newspaper. At the very least, they have a newspaper. And This is a nice little article. It's shorter. It's called A Surge of Strikes Shakes the Elite. So, okay, so I painted a kind of doom and gloom picture there with that article. That writer there was just pretty bombastic. And it's rightfully so. But what do you do about it, right? So I gave a little premise to that. Now for the punchline with what is happening that is encouraging. That gives me hope. And so I'm not going to think it's some cynical, there's nothing we can do. So this is by L. Zorfass, and it was written February 14th. And the pitcher is a woman, with a sign that says, "My second job bought this sign." A Denver teacher on strike. Okay, start reading. Over the past year, there have been more labor strikes and marches than in recent memory. Across the country, working class people have been standing up against the capitalist elite and their state in increasing numbers and in diverse locations. From factory closings to Supreme Court rulings, labor issues have been in the news cycle more and more frequently as organized labor continues to mobilize. The reason for this mobilization is not merely to demand more money or equitable wages, but also to reveal that contradictions of capitalism are becoming more and more exposed, affecting more and more people. The concept of a general strike, not heard of in the U.S. since the days of Eugene Debs, 1930s, has returned to popular political discourse and once again puts the capitalist elite on edge. The leading element of that class in all its bigotries, the Trump administration, could be protested for just about everything it does. Its attack on working class Americans have been swift and significant. Trump administration attacked working class directly by repealing pro-labor laws of the past, attacking public education, and minority groups. Teachers have been striking year-round all over the country due to divestment of public education and the state investment into private education, creating an even more elitist and segmented education system. Just this week, on February 13th, 37,000 Denver teachers walked out on strike for better wages and funding for their students. And by the way, they won within the week. Power structure bended to them. And it didn't take long. These strikes that defy... Oh yeah, another in Arizona. Known for its social conservatism, registered Republicans went on strike demanding higher taxes to fund their schools. These strikes are that defy traditional political boundaries between red and blue states underlies the growing class consciousness, as put by this paper, in the United States. The labor struggle, long dormant, is now leading the charge in a reawakened class conscious movement against inequality. So the call for movements and things, it's happening. It's happening. We just got to join or be aware of it and do it in the places where it's not happening. We have some unionization happening in my area, but it's very slow. It's very small. I wish it was higher. Something to be involved with. I show up to solidarity picket. Despite these grassroots movements, though, labor unions continue to lose legal power and have less political influence. Many of these strikes are, in fact, also against their union leadership. Labor laws nearly a century old have been repealed, right? Talked about that already. Collective bargaining rights continue to be trampled on. So, this, you know, the consolidation, the creation of a corporate state described in the first section. But despite a good economy, wages have fallen and factories have closed. Massive protests are seen in North America when GM closed half a dozen plants. United Steel workers are ready to strike for higher wages. These same workers, in the millions, are also told how great the economy is doing. Trump's tax cuts, touted as a boon, have instead punished them with higher taxes and brought back only 6% of the money corporations keep abroad in tax-free bank accounts. Alongside the attack on labor is an increasing threat of white supremacist and far-right violence, aimed particularly at people of color and women. Physical attacks by police on minorities continue as their rights get stripped away. Rise of calls for terrorism and mentions Venezuela as well. But here's the important underlying story. This all culminated in this year's government shutdown, which happened as a result of disagreement between the Democratic House and President Trump over funding a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. A highly imperialist, xenophobic, and racist policy that has become nothing more than a dog whistle for fascist aggression against immigrants. Shutdown left over 800,000 government workers without pay for weeks. Following the reopening of the sectors of the government that were shut down, many of the lower-paid and unskilled workers were refused back pay, such as contractors, which Trump has specifically denied back pay to. That's nothing new for him. But here's maybe unreported, or less underreported. But the reopening of the government and the end of the shutdown was the result of the Association of Flight Attendants threatening to go on strike and shut down many of America's airports. The fear not just of massive loss of profits such a strike could cause, but also the spreading of this strike struck a deep fear. The spreading of this strike struck a deep fear into the ruling elite and brought the weeks-long impasse to a hasty end. Because our airports are definitely like a weak point. It's a weak point for terrorism. It's also a weak point for the ruling class. How are they going to get to their parties in Florida and their golf trips and all the traveling? They do the most traveling, okay? So airport closures hurt them way more. Way more. So closing the airports, whether it be the traffic controllers, but they didn't want to go on strike because it is in fact dangerous. They would bring in people who were less experienced, and that would be dangerous for the planes and all the people on them. But if it's the flight attendants, then the planes wouldn't lift off in the first place. So that means then the traffic controllers could also go on strike. It had to start with the people at the bottom of the supply chain, meaning in this case, flight attendants, which are all millennials now, by the way. Because, you know, they hire him young. Because of this, it appears the Democrats and Trump have reached a compromise in which part of the wall is funded. Goody, goody. Both the Democrats and Republicans are upset, though, accusing their leaders of respectively caving to the other side. But this is the wrong conclusion. Neither side caved. They did what was necessary to keep the working class from mobilizing, from experiencing its own power. But these increasing contradictions have also been met with global labor movement that cuts across the spectrum and fights bigotry and working class unity against greedy and indifferent bosses. As these contradictions lay bare before working class, the more its members are compelled to organize, first within each industry and then for other classes, it is imperative that the American working class recognize itself as a class again. All right. Politics isn't a team sport. Focus on policies. But if you go to form teams, choose your team wisely. Do it based on who's actually harming you and your actual condition. Okay? Right? If you're fired from your job, it's your boss. It's the corporation that hurt you, not the illegal immigrant. Unless, you know, it's like, oh, I didn't have a choice. Okay, so an immigrant has more power than the corporate boss? All right, turn it in. Thank you for listening. This is the end of the first hour.
Well, it's best to know the worth of what you got before it's gone. But you can't let yourself get stuck because you're afraid you might be wrong. You're nostalgic for 68. I'm nostalgic for 99. But sometimes thinking back too much can make you close your eyes. Cause what we do today matters both today and tomorrow. Well, the point of learning history is to build something new. I don't care what you read about unless it impacts what you do. You wanna recreate 68, you wanna recreate 99. Try learning their hard lessons to reflect and then refine. Cause the good old days just suck sometimes. If you ask those who were there, and the answers weren't just blown in the wind, they were put there. What we do today matters both today and tomorrow. History gets simplified with the passing on of time. And causes and effects sometimes take decades to define. I've seen the long shadow of 68 by the ruins of the Berlin Wall. I've seen the long shadow of 68 in Seattle. Looking back from here now, all the pieces seem to fit. Sometimes it's hard to notice the changing world when you're right inside of it. But without us, future is a boat without a sail. Without our best attempts, we set the next ones up to fail. What we do today matters both today and tomorrow.
Welcome, welcome to the second hour of the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. A quick word of housekeeping from me. A reminder, word of mouth is the best thing to do. Your part in growing the show and a number of like-minded comrades. You could leave a review on podcast platforms in which this show is on, all of. Except I didn't see it on Podbean, so I'll have to do something about that. And share Three Left via your chosen social media platform, with the most effective means being word of mouth in real life. We are on Facebook, Twitter. By the way, on all episodes like this one will be posted in one-hour chunks. To support the show materially, visit our Patreon page, Three Left Show, and become a member there. Money for outreach is a specific goal. Links are in the show description. Sources for each episode are in the show info tab and listed on our website, threelefts.news. A full backlog of episodes also there, and other info and resources. And sources I put on the face page, Three Left Show. If you don't use Facebook, I've been trying to get sources of links. So I was just talking about strikes and union organizing with many thousands of people. But what if you're not part of a sector that's unionized or even potentially unionized? Could be. Unionization is very difficult. There are many impediments that prevent it. And some of them could have been removed during the opening years of the Obama administration, but it wasn't pushed, and Obama didn't care. One of the things that kind of led to me throwing the Democrats in the garbage is that there was a chance to make unionization easier, and the Democrats, with their majorities, didn't lift a finger. But here is an example. So I just talked about strike movement stuff, so I'm going to continue with that, with two stories of simple activism that is either legal or extra legal, but for this story here is a legal form. So it's slower, it's a more matter of persistence, and but the results are substantial. So this is a story from Hartford. The current source is from their local paper. These tenants took on a millionaire absentee landlord and won. They had no organizing experience, no legal representation, and for some not even a high school diploma. But over the past 11 months, close to a year, five tenants of the North End Affordable Housing Complex emerged as the public faces of a successful campaign to oust their landlord, Queens resident Emmanuel Koo. Taking on City Hall, the feds, and Koo, the group met once a week, collecting signatures for petitions, posting flyers, and helping other tenants fill out hundreds of complaint forms that they filed with Hartford City Hall. And last Thursday, beleaguered residents living in 150 units in a 26 apartment buildings found taped to their doors letters telling them that the U.S. Department of Housing and HUD, and Urban Development, also known as HUD, was revoking its million-dollar contract with Koo, who had left them to live with vermin and other health hazards for years. HUD had finally agreed to relocate his hundreds of tenants to, as they quoted, properties that are in decent, safe, and sanitary condition. Quoting one of the organizers, "We actually got HUD to come to the table for us. It's kind of surreal to hear that," said Josh Serena, who among with Terry Morrison, Magagos Ortiz, Ulyssa Yumiska, and Jesslyn Sion, took the campaign against Koo City Hall and HUD. "It's been rough dealing with them, but they've made what we call a righteous decision," said Serena, who has lived in a Koo-owned building for 13 years. Morrison, who lives in one of Koo's Albany Avenue building with four children and a granddaughter, has come back to the doctor's appointment when she saw the letter from HUD tucked between her door and frame. She assumed it was a notice that Koo had been granted another extension to make repairs. She read the first sentence, that the letter terminates the Section 8 housing assistance payments, and then she sat on the edge of her bed and cried. I think these are tears of joy. "As a parent, you feel responsible for the safety and well-being of your kids," Morrison said. "When you know that you don't have any control over what runs through your walls, you don't want to get cited for putting your kids in harm's way. What was one of the main concerns? Should I go live in a shelter? Should I abandon my apartment?" When they went public last July, and that phrase go like went public. I read a book years ago now. It's called Going Public. Great book about movement building on the basically on the street level. And going public, and I'm going to sidetrack here, tangent here, because going public is kind of step one when it comes to this stuff. Go public with your complaint. Sometimes it's like a letter to the editor or complaining at a council meeting, but as an individual, that's really meaningless. Go public as a group. Find the people who have the same disagreements as you. Now, this can be difficult and maybe even scary if you've never done it before, but a canvas of your neighbors or a canvas of the people in your group or your coworkers. Now, I think things kind of go flat, like, say, with union organizing, if, say, you talk to all your coworkers about unionizing and they all don't want to do it. So they don't have the same complaints as you, or they do, but I'm going to go look for a different job. I think all the jobs are going to have the same problems then, if you let these things go. When they went public last July with the disrepair and vermin within the buildings, the tenants had no understanding of HUD's labyrinthine codes and regulations. They didn't know which codes were the purview of the city, the state, or the federal government. They didn't know what technically Koo had done wrong. Only that mice still scuttled across the floor at night, that broken windows still bled heat, and mold still coated their ceilings. "We Googled everything," said Ortiz, a single mother of three children. "We Googled what HUD's responsibility was. What were the codes? What did the codes mean? How much time this code gets? HUD has so many codes. This code gets 30 days. This code gets 60 days. 90 days. They demanded that the city step up its inspections of Koo's buildings, which he failed, those inspections. They asked Tax Abatement Committee to rescind an arrangement that netted cut hundreds of thousands of dollars in tax relief each year, which he lost. They met with HUD officials and asked how Koo could keep his contract when his buildings had been cited for nearly 2,000 violations last summer. Why Koo had been given until March 31st to pass a reinspection, which he failed. They held everyone's feet to the fire," the mayor of Hartford, Luke Bronin, said. "The rule of law oftentimes seems slow and cumbersome." But they, and this is the mayor speaking, okay? So this is the mayor defending, okay? That's slow, it's cumbersome, but they were persistent throughout this. Oh, I'm sorry, no, this is not the mayor speaking. This is a representative, John Larson, who asked HUD Secretary Ben Carson to reevaluate Koo's contract, and they never gave up. So their local representative, congressional representative, had to call up Sleepy Boy Ben Carson, the HUD secretary, to actually intervene. You have to go to the top, baby. Bottom up. With the help of the Christian Activities Council, a Hartford social justice group, the tenants brought together HUD, the city of Hartford, and Connecticut's congressional delegation, which Larson is part of, I guess, and the chief state attorney's office to try to bring Koo into compliance. So you have to bring all these people together because power is kind of distributed that way, and thus, but also responsibility is too. Which is kind of a good thing, like fun is a good thing. But if we're going to have a central power structure with the federal government, like it needs to be more direct. Otherwise, it is elaborate. What's unheard of normally, they're separate entities, Serrano said, but I look at the outcome when everybody has a show face at the same table. There's no finger pointing. Everyone takes responsibility for what they are able to do. Okay, so being in person definitely helps. In fact, probably necessary. Ciano, who's 26, younger than me, dropped out of high school at 15 when his son was born. Now he's 10, he's steady, and he's got a good co-parent relationship with his mom, Serrano said. So it's the right time for my education. He's been taking GED classes at Barber Branch. A lot of this article later on goes into each of their personal stories, so I might just stop here. People think they don't have rights, but you have rights, Ortiz says. You have to fight for them. Ortiz, 33, lives in the brick Main Street building with her three children and a Yorkie service dog for her artistic son. Her apartment is decorated with maps as if to show the breadth of the world and its possibilities for her children, for multiple different ages. She now works at a Family Dollar in East Hartford. But for much of last year, by the way, Hartford as a city is very much like my city of Albany. It's these East Coast, sort of Rust Belt cities, Hartford has the advantage that a bunch of big insurance companies have headquarters there. That doesn't really matter, though, for the urban area, well, basically the city itself. So you basically have a working population that lives in the suburbs around Hartford, and you have a inner city which is still underdeveloped, underinvested, and it's for black people. Surprise, surprise. At first, the tenants made basic demands. No more rodents or mold, working phone lines, regular business hours for the management office, and that the office filed their paperwork correctly so their subsidies would be renewed. But as time went on and both sides dug in, the tenants took aim at the pillars supporting Coos Hartford portfolio. We saw the problem was at the roots. There was the abatement arranged in 2014 that reduced Coos' tax burden by 80%. There was the HUD contract that has given Coos more than $10 million in subsidies since 2011. And there was his long history documented by this newspaper of flouting regulations with few repercussions and little concern for residents, meaning the city government was ignoring him. The bottom line is, we're going after the guy, Larson said. Whatever he does will not matter, but we've got to take care of the residents, because they've had the temerity, they've had the courage, and they've had the persistence. The residents of Coos' 150 apartments must now uproot themselves to find a landlord willing to take a HUD voucher. The agency has promised to give them relocation assistance and to hire contractors who will help them find and move into new quarters. Serrano stressed that this was not a campaign to smear Coos, get a relocation voucher, and blow Dodge. They hoped he'd repair his buildings or sell to someone who would, so they would go on living in what has been, for some of them, home for decades. A teenage Serrano raised his son in Coos' brick named the Main Street building. Now they've been scattered to whatever lodging they can find. This is what due process gets you, Serrano said. We didn't just come out here maliciously and say, we want vouchers. No, we came and we spoke to everybody. We went to every level of the law, and as the letter says, this was the last resort. Right? Especially when you're facing a guy or some capitalist who is not going to give up what they think they have earned. So thank you for joining us. This is Three Left Show, making both horseshoes and horseshoe theory a thing of the past. Story called There's a Quiet Protest Happening in the Trees of Appalachia. Now it's catching on. By Megyn Kelly. Not the Megyn Kelly you're probably thinking of. And this is called, this is from Upworthy. I haven't read Upworthy in years. When Abigail peeks out of her perch, right, that's mostly because Upworthy kind of focuses on, maybe if uncharitably called, you know, fluff pieces, personal stories. But I think that's what's called for, since now for what could be described as a human interest story. When Abigail peeks out of her perch, a wooden platform dangling high in a tree of a mountain ridge in West Virginia, she sees a nearly picture-perfect landscape. She points out roaming farm animals and watches cars drive the few country roads that border the Jefferson National Forest. The 22-year-old Virginian, who asked not to disclose her last name because of a risk in the protest, has called a sweeping landscape around Peter's Mountain and this one tree home since she and others climbed up its branches on a mission February of 2018. She chose the tree that she's in for a reason. It sits right where the Mountain Valley Pipeline is slated to carry natural gas through the fragile limestone terrain beneath its roots. Construction of this pipeline would mean the destruction of this landscape, and Abigail is determined to stall that as long as possible. The route moves north of Clarksville, West Virginia, down and just southeast of Roanoke, Virginia, where it's been proposed it will continue another 70 miles south into North Carolina. The 42-inch diameter pipeline will carry fracked natural gas. Residents like Becky Crabtree, who lives along the route, fear for their health, communities, and land. Rightfully so. We can't find record of a pipeline of this size ever being built on such steep grade, Crabtree says. There are so many questions we have, and no one is answering any of them. Mostly because the answers are not very good. Crabtree's property at the base of Peters Mountain is intersected by the pipeline, and her concerns about it are endless. She worries about sinkholes, about the quality of water reservoirs in the area, and about the construction traffic planned on her little one-lane road. She worries about the fence around her sheep field, and she'll have to pay to rebuild once the pipeline widens that road for their use. She worries about the effect the pipeline will have on the Appalachian Trail, which it will cross under just a couple hundred feet from Abigail's tree. And all these problems, by the way, are not imagined. These are all problems that have occurred after other pipelines have been built, recent pipelines. Armed with many of the same concerns as Crabtree, over 400 landowners along the pipeline's route refused to grant the MVP, that's the pipeline, easements on their property. These landowners were sued by the company in 2017 for access to the land. Eventually, a federal court will grant the private company access by condemning each person's land through eminent domain, claiming that the pipeline serves a public good. Now, personally, I don't like being a statist, but I find that eminent domain could be used for good, but as it's the corporate state that's wielding it, it's bad. Just a few dozen miles from Abigail, a 60-year-old woman nicknamed Red has also taken to the trees to stop pipeline construction on her family's Virginia land. "When I saw the tree sits on Peter's Mountain," Red Terry says, "I knew what we had to do." Her husband's family had lived on the Roanoke County land for generations, preserving the streams, the wetlands, and the historic orchard that the pipeline will run right through. "Everyone wants MVP's money," she quips, "but there are some things in life worth a hell of a lot more than money." Red's tree sit, like Abigail's, has been surrounded by tree felling in recent weeks, but the presence of the tree sitters, along with dozens of supporters on the ground, have prevented MVP from cutting many trees in the pipeline's path. Although the community supporting these protests is vast, the threat of legal consequences have kept many, like Abigail, from disclosing other personal information. As construction ramps up, Red and Abigail aren't the only ones taking action. The Delaware County, Virginia, a blockade was erected by pipeline opponents on an MVP access road. A single protester has been perched atop a 50-foot log placed vertically in the road for 3 weeks and counting, effectively halting construction of both the access road and the pipeline. She has not come down once, despite the continued presence of law enforcement preventing supporters from replenishing her supply of food and water. The banner hanging with her aptly reads, "The fire's catching, no pipeline." Back in West Virginia, Crabtree says she was jumping up and down delighted to learn about the folks who climbed into the trees on Peter's Mountain. "We haven't noticed them until we read about them," she says, "but the more people that learn about them, the more admiration there is in this community. The more sense there is that we support people that lay it down for our environment, that takes courage and wherewithal." Local supporters have been so grateful for the tree sitters that in just a couple weeks, they held a spaghetti dinner and fundraiser support. Up in her oak tree, Abigail recounts tales of the past 3 years, which she has spent opposing this pipeline. Again, tales from persistence, because this takes many years of fighting. "It got to the point where we have tried all of these options to fight this. We talked to our representatives. We tried running our own candidates. We wrote letters to the editor. We had people sign petitions. Didn't work. Didn't work. Didn't work. This is the only thing I feel we have held left." So in the case of Hartford, it worked there, as far as doing these listed things, going public and whatnot. But in rural areas, no, not so much. Maybe the representatives are, in fact, bought. And in this case, these are big multinationals. And in the other case, it was a pretty much small-time landlord. You know, it was $1 million in tax breaks. And in this, it's billions of dollars of exported fracked gas. So when, you know, different scale. And a different scale of kind of people opposing it. So, but direct action gets the goods when all other legal means are exhausted. This fight comes at a time of widespread increasing resistance to pipelines and other destructive fossil fuel projects around the country and the world. Just east of the MVP route, folks are fighting the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the natural gas one as well, among a multitude of other issues. So much for being a bridge to the future, right? Among other issues, it has a compressor station planned for Union Hill, Virginia, a community built by the descendants of freed slaves. Down in Louisiana, the Bayou Bridge Pipeline is scheduled to cross 700 bodies of water, including a reservoir that supplies drinking water to the United Human Nation, 300,000 Louisiana residents. This is the tail end of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which thousands protested last year at Standing Rock and continue to fight. The list goes on. Mariner East 2, Rover, Line 3, Trans Mountain. So do the stories of people rising up in the face of this ongoing destruction of land and communities. I don't have a lot to lose being in this tree. But as a young person and person from this region, I do have a lot to lose with this pipeline. Follow Appalachians Against Pipelines and Farmlands Fighting Pipelines on Facebook. To learn about some of the other pipeline fights mentioned here, follow No Bayou Bridge, MACA Initiative, and Camp White Pine. A few months ago, I covered a story about up in Canada, and that was like mass. And that story was mostly about how, whether it be a tree set or blocking roads, it does hurt these multinationals. It costs them money. You make it expensive enough, and eventually they will back off. But it just has to cost enough. And that takes persistence. It means not giving up, because if you do, it's a signal that like they just have to suck it out, and then they can reap their billion over the body of people like us. So it's no wonder that, to quote the title of the next story I'm covering from GQ magazine, the surging popularity of socialism has Republican politicians terrified. Kind of making it about teams, but I'm pretty sure there's plenty of Democratic politicians that are just as scared. They're freaking out. And they're fighting back with fear-mongering, obfuscation, and the old-fashioned red baiting. Red baiting is when you, you know, I think used it in one of my... This is written by Luke Darby. So overall, this story is about kind of, he defines socialism in a good way, in a way that I agree with. Sets up the next story that I'll finish the show with. So from going up from activism on the ground, going back up to the level of talking about the general trend of our time. And this is actually written right after the State of the Union. So, but again, I'm not reading this and covering this right after the State of the Union, because this is a general trend that we'll all be seeing more of and have seen plenty of in the past few years. Donald Trump's most recent State of the Union address doesn't merit heaps of scrutiny, considering that consisted almost entirely of empty bluster. But one particular point, and it was a lot longer than me or the people I watched it with expected. It was like 40 minutes long, longer than others. But one particular point he made worth digging into, and I think it will be, and it is being repeated, it's practically his campaign slogan now. Since we're likely going to hear a lot about it, mostly in ominous tones from members of his party and the Democrats. America was founded on liberty and independence, he said, and will not govern, and are not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free. Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country. His Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin echoed Trump's words in an interview. The U.S. economy is doing terrific, Mnuchin said from the White House. And as the president talked about last night, his economic plan is working. We're not going back to socialism. We're not going back. So to the right, socialism is just that liberal state I was talking about earlier, where corporations are regulated. Oh, that's painful. We're going on an economic plan for America that works. We don't believe in centralized planning economy where the government puts restraints on it. Basically saying corporation power, corporate power over state power. But it's one and the same. They're liars. If you're listening to this, you likely don't like them. The phrase going back to socialism is a curious one given the country's history. But it aligns with the bizarre right-wing talking point that capitalism somehow stops happening when you raise taxes slightly. Really, Republican politicians and pundits have spent the past decade or so calling everything any Democrat did socialism, to remind people of the late autocratic Soviet Union. This habit ignores that many developed countries have established socialist parties and instituted socialist programs without instituting gulags, too. Socialism isn't a clarion call for state-administered capitalism, where the well-off still call the shots while also occupying the highest positions of power of government. Socialism instead refers to small d democratic control of resources, where a greater number of people have a say in what society does. Now, if you're a follower of Bernie Sanders, this is in the form of using liberal democracy to do so. So you elect the people who are going to manage it. So, you know, it's democratic control through reps. There's a lot of problems with that, and I think everyone has a sense of that already, but we still want something better than what we have now, and that would be better. In his speech, Trump focused on Venezuela, where his administration has declared its opposition to the incumbent socialist government by recognizing the country's opposition leader as right for president. Conditions in Venezuela are disastrous, and for conservative pundits, it seems to vindicate their assertion that no viable alternative to pure, unfettered capitalism exists. However, much as some people might suffer under capitalism, they claim at least they aren't starving. Except many people are starving in America. Writing in Current Affairs magazine, however, Nathan Robinson points out that under Maduro, Venezuela is socialist in name only. Country's leaders have shown no interest in fighting inequality and instead have taken to hoarding wealth while public services and institutions fall apart. Venezuela, then, can tell us a lot about kleptocracy, but it can't tell us anything about socialism. Although I've mentioned in other episodes that there is a growing and very strong commune and community empowerment movement that has been supported and funded by the quote-unquote socialist government. So, and my story that I mentioned before was that these communes don't need the government anymore because they can actually stand on their own. They don't need the government and they don't need corporate power. They need neither. That's the goal in my eyes. Robinson goes on to say that as long as the system perpetuates inequality at such stark levels, which, by the way, another factoid, Venezuela's economy is still 70% private. And they have their oligarchs as well. That's what the opposition in Venezuela is. It's their oligarchy, corporate oligarchy. Our corporate oligarchy controls our government, so no calls for regime change. If Bernie and a bunch of other Justice Democrats were elected, and by bunch I mean like 100 of them, that would probably constitute as regime change in America. And here it is. With a second Bernie Sanders presidential run now present, and with a rising popularity of self-described democratic socialist politicians like AOC and Rashida Tlaib, both Republicans and corporate-friendly Democrats have begun invoking the ghosts of Soviet-era Russia. In July of last year, NBC News reported on a panel hosted by a centrist think tank in which an array of democratic politicians worried about how they could combat renewed interest in socialism. Ohio Representative Tim Ryan earned laughs from the crowd when he announced, "You're not going to make me hate somebody just because they're rich. I want to be rich." They have good reason to be worried, though. Opinion polling finds the American public is on board with a host of ideas, including Medicaid for all, single-payer health care, that politicians and pundits refer to as being socialist. And it is getting increasingly difficult for politicians to argue that, in the wealthiest country in the world, people should have to worry about going bankrupt to pay for things like insulin. Mnuchin's brand of buzzword-heavy fear-mongering is the best chance his party has to prevent an unpopular agenda. Yeah, so if anything, this writer defines socialism as being like social democracy or democratic socialism, which is still, you still have parliamentary government where central power lies, and maybe they'll do the planning, or at least you have things like consolidated health insurance, which doesn't plan how health care is delivered, it simply plans how paid for. So I'm going to finish the show. So I just referenced a GQ article kind of talking about the rise of socialism, aka democratic socialism, but still left-wing politics in general. And it's good. I like it. It's what I've been waiting for the last, I guess, 6 years since the Occupy movement. So this last piece is from the Gideon Journal. "Our Pens Are Our Swords." Popped up in my Facebook feed, because I read so much of what socialism is. And it's called "Fool's Gold, Socialism is Just Capitalism Inverted." Now, there's a twist here as I go through this. So it seems like this is an anti-socialism article, but it actually isn't. More like I'm reading this to make my own argument. Republicans and Democrats, you know, the corporate state, uses socialism a certain way to refer to higher taxes, government regulations, and just social programs, which is not the case. And I'm going to lay it out. Socialism is worker control of the economy, or means of production, which just refers to the things you need to get things done, right? Could be land, machinery, capital stacks, which are, you know, refers to money. Creation of money is privately controlled, and the management of our economy is private. It is controlled by the few, it is controlled by capitalists. Capitalist control of the economy, that is what capitalism is, and socialism refers to social control of the economy. And this is usually meant to mean the government, since the state is like a stand-in, a proxy for the people, but it's not a very good one. I think we all agree on that. But there are many people it does not work for. My utopian thinking is to have a system, a government, or an economy that works for everyone. And that means it needs to be socially controlled in some way. Okay? We can argue about how, but as far as what socialism means, so that's kind of what the argument is. Does it mean government control? Does it mean top-down control? Does it mean, you know, how do you define society? If you define society as being oppressive, as being groups suppressing individuality, which is a misnomer, then yeah, socialism is bad, it's evil. But if you mean social control as in community control, as in community empowerment. So this guy is actually, I'm actually been quoting this guy the whole time here at the show. Let me from the outset, I'm going to skip some parts, but let me get from the outset, even though it saddens me to do so, I know that a lot of people coming to this article triggered by the thought that I'm about to bash the political heroes. Likewise, an equal number of people are also sprinting to this article like Usain Bolt on fire, thinking that I'm about to take the political nemesis to the woodshed. But let me disabuse you of these thoughts. I'm not here to feed into the pre-existing notions of people who are wedded to politics above reason. This guy is not a cheerleader of capitalism, and he, the first part of his article, which I don't need to repeat, capitalism is cancerous, pretty much already covered in this episode, and the last one, why it is. Most of us are waking up to the fact that capitalism is broken. Alas, we have been so thoroughly conditioned as a society to accept capitalism as the very meaning of America that to question a system that profits few while humanity suffers is akin to kicking kittens. True enough, capitalism built up a flourishing middle class in the past and makes it possible for me to write this article that is going to reach thousands of people before the day is over. I'm going to take issue with that. Says capitalism built up the middle class. The New Deal era built up the middle class. What is the New Deal era? I covered this. It was social movements pushing the capitalism to be more fair. The middle class made itself. It was working class people demanding more, and they got it. They got more, and thus the middle class was made. And capitalism exists because of workers. You know, profit is made by workers. Managers can add some value, but value starts with the work. So he calls what we have strangle up economics. America is the largest pyramid scheme in the history of humanity. I'll make other allusions to this another time. The bottom 90% are the base of the pyramid, the top 9% to the top it, and have escaped the gravitational pull of inflation, while the top 1 are the capstones who literally harvest humans as crops. What none of these bankrupt politicians and vacuous media personalities refuse to talk about is how the system of fractional reserve banking transfers wealth upward. In this dynamic, inflation is the new slave ship, and debt is a 21st century form of enslavement. So the next two paragraphs, I want to make clear, I'm disagreeing with. Yet, as immoral as capitalism is, socialism is no better. I've written about this in the past and explained that communism is just as flawed as capitalism. Both systems depend on central authorities lording over all of us. Now, of course, as a left libertarian, I do have critiques of the Soviet Union and state socialism, as it's called. But a part of me is also supportive of these efforts because they are kind of going in the right direction. But this guy kind of seems to paint with a broad brush, just as he did that capitalism built the middle class. He's saying that all socialism, or if you're going to use the word, you're referring only to authoritarian communism, which to me is inaccurate. But let me go on. Handling our power over the technocrats, politicians, and bureaucrats, whether those governments happen to be for the social good or capital in makeup, and expecting them to do the right thing by the people is the height of foolishness. John Darberg Afton once said, "Absolute power corrupts absolutely." Of course, this is a man who was in power. He was dead on accurate with this observation. There is nothing as corrosive as power that is consolidated by a few. Oh yeah, and he uses the line, "A sip from the chalice of authority metastasizes the ego and makes monsters out of people." I know they will never teach our children this in school, but let me break some news here. America stopped being a republic a long time ago, democracy being dead. Federalist hijacked, but he's actually referring to the very beginning of the American Republic. When Federalist hijacked the experiment in self-governance and replaced it with an odious central government that is guarded jealously by two factions, Democrats and Republicans, and the media political complex, who all work ostensibly for their corporate masters. As always, revolutions devolve into the same tyranny that gave birth to them. So anti-revolution rhetoric here, too. I think this guy is actually quite conservative, which is interesting that he kind of, the first quarter of this is an anti-capitalist greed. Then he goes into an anti-socialist greed. Let's see. And he goes into the history. The levies that inspired the American Revolution were downright quaint compared to the onerous taxes and fees that are bleeding the vast majority of Americans dry. Parenthetically, the callous belly for the revolution has been replaced with propaganda. I'll save that story for another day. I wish we had all we had to worry about was the Stamp Act, sugar, and tea act. Instead, we are being bludgeoned by the IRS, which is anti-constitutional by and by. Okay, that's a right-wing stance. And forced to pay a third of our income in taxes, while billionaires like Jeff Bezos, of a right-libertarian stance, I will mention. So I think that's where this guy's coming from. King George was a saint compared to the corporate state boot that is stepping on our collective neck. And he mentions this man is... So, by the way, I write about capitalism and socialism from a first-hand perspective. My family and I were forced to flee my native land of Ethiopia once the Derg communist government took over. The Derg rose to power under the guise of returning the land to the people and giving power to the proletariat. Mengistu Haminemon ended up killing 500,000 Ethiopians. The lands they gave the people were their graves. Revolutions are fought by the idealists and hijacked by opportunists. This is a standard right-wing talking point. When it comes to expats, like people who flee communist governments, they're usually the people who, like, were landowners. Expat communities of, say, Venezuelans and Cubans in Florida, who are right-wing and anti-socialist, they're the people who are the landowners. They're the people who are the landlords, the people who profited. So maybe his family was the same. I don't know. He's not going to say. But I'm going to make an inference, because the people who talk this way about, like, they took the land in the name of the people, but then they went, you know, they were corrupt and they did everything wrong and they were monsters. I think that is oversimplification. But there is a different path. I hate to give a name to this alternative, given that ideologies end up creating the very consolidated power that I just spoke against. I disagree with that as well, anti-ideology. So. But I guess if we must give this new option a name, let's call it communalism. So here's the twist. Communalism, to my knowledge, okay, is a left-wing stance, right? It simply means bottom-up socialism. As far as all the readings and all the other people who use communalism, they're the scary left-wing revolutionaries fighting for community power. Communalism is what the founders of America had in mind. So he tries to make this nationalist. Had in mind when they tried to constrain the size of central government and instead wanted to empower states and localities. These ideas of limited government and local governance have become radioactive after proponents of slavery rallied to the side of the Confederacy. As soon as someone says states' rights is the minute they get mugged with accusations of being racist. Oh, he's not racist. Well, he's a black man from Ethiopia. Not here to defend all people who go around espousing states' rights, however. It was only a generation ago that black folks, puts black in quotations, were put through the hell of fire hoses and police dogs of the states' rights proponents. What many don't see is that there are demagogues in the establishment who intentionally shred open the historical scars of racism and bigotry. The color lines are prisons that prevent healing conversation. Jab at identity politics. Oh, here we go. So in talking about communalism, but he mentions Fred Hampton and Huey Newton. These were left-wing revolutionary black activists. And others like Angela Davis and so on. It's interesting. I mean, what I'm for is communalism. I'm for the same thing that this guy is. And I think he's coming from it from a right libertarian perspective, and I'm coming from a left libertarian perspective. And it translates to basically the same thing, community empowerment, and references the manifesto of this online newspaper of sorts, Gideon Journal, and makes a call for left-right unite movement, as many do these days. Oh yeah, and he says that, you know, Bernie Sanders wasted an opportunity in 2016, the opportunity not to run as an independent. So yeah, I kind of agree with him on that. And, oh yeah, and this was written by Theoros Finkel, and he's the founder of this site. But he's profoundly changed by a two-year journey of hardship and struggle, going from a life of upper middle class privilege, which might tell you his family background and why they left Ethiopia, to a time spent with the huddled masses taught Theoros a valuable lesson in the essence of togetherness and the need to speak against injustice. He was incorporated into Barack Obama's South Carolina primary speech in 2008. He pivoted away from politics and decided to stand for collective justice after experiencing the reality of the forgotten masses. And that is really how people's minds are really changed, is by changing their experiences. So I'm just going to leave you with that, and thank you for listening. Be well, stay active, stay frosty. Thank you very much.